broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
He always thought of the sea as La Mar, which is what people call her in Spanish when they love her. Sometimes those who love her say bad things of her, but they are always said as though she were a woman. Some of the younger fishermen who used buoys as floats for their lines and had motorboats bought when the shark livers had brought so much money, spoke of her as El Mar, which is masculine. They spoke of her as a contestant, or a place, or even an enemy. But the old man always thought of her as feminine, as something that gave or withheld great favors. And if she did wild or wicked things, it was because she could not help them. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Well, it's June on the Delmarva, and the call of the sea gains increasing strength each day along with the warming times. Why is it that we flock to the beach, or at least to the water's edge each summer? Perhaps, and we can only speculate here, the pull of the sea is actually a call to return to the place of our primal beginnings. Our ancestors, after all, came crawling out of the sea some 350 million years ago, give or take a few million years, to become air-breathing creatures. We still carry the traits of those beginnings. We are created in water, a private sea in which we live and grow for 9 months, again, give or take. And our bodies are between 70 to 60% water, depending on our age. In addition, the mineral composition of the water in our cells is basically that of the sea. Is it any wonder, then, that being by the sea, playing in it, smelling it, feeling its caresses, brings us comfort and a degree of peace? In The Old Man and the Sea, from our readings that I began with, Hemingway thought of the sea as feminine, as something that gave and withheld great favors. And if she did wild or wicked things, it was because she could not help them. Like a great mother, in her way, the sea has now released us to the land, but her call remains ever strong. Beach Reads is a fictional literary genre that explores and celebrates our desire to be next to the sea. My guests today on Delmarva Today Writers Edition are Nancy Sakadusky and Nancy Pawlikowski Sherman. Nancy Sakadusky is the founder of Cat and Mouse Press. Its purpose is to support writers in our local area and create what Nancy calls playful books with a connection to the Delmarva shore. Nancy Sherman is a fiction writer. She writes both short stories and tells me that, like so many others of us, has a number of novels in the works. We'll see, Nancy, where those novels go. Again, like the rest of us. Sandy Shorts, her first book of short stories, was awarded a regional first place by Delaware Press Association and national first place by the National Federation of Press Women in 2015. Nancy and Nancy, welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Nancy Sakadusky, let me begin with you. You are no stranger to Delmarva Public Radio, and True. You are certainly no stranger to the Writer's Edition. Tell us a bit about Cat and Mouse Press and your work with local authors.
Well, we run the Rehoboth Beach Reads Short Story Contest every year, and that, in fact, is how I met Nancy Sherman to begin with. It's a short story contest that runs till July 1st, and we look for short beach reads that connect to the year's theme. This year, our theme was beach dreams, but each year it's a different theme. So that's one of our biggest projects. But as you said at the beginning, we create playful books. They are beach reads for both adults and children, but they all have a connection to the Delmarva region.
Well, Nancy Sherman, tell us a bit about yourself and how you came to be a writer of fiction.
Oh, well, I'm an only child, and so growing up, I had no siblings to play around with games and all, and I always liked to make up stories. Even in grade school, I would make up stories and share them with my friends. And I thought I was going to be a writer, and I went to undergraduate school and chickened out and instead did something else for my degree. And then years later, after doing many decades of theater acting and directing, I realized that I needed to get back to writing, and that's my total focus in this 25% left of my life.
25%, my goodness. we'll go for a little bit more than that. Can't we? You were an actress and a director. What kind of acting work did you do?
Mostly musical theater, because at that point dinner theaters were very popular and summer theaters were and still are. So I worked non-professionally. I made a living as a teacher in the Baltimore County Public School System and then at Stevenson University before I moved here. So during that time, I taught composition, literature, and theater. So I taught acting classes and improv classes, and that was great. It actually helped with the writing, I think. I think it makes a better writer if you can understand from a character's point of view what's going on and put yourself into that. And I just eventually realized that it was time to go back to writing, and so that's what I've done.
Well, let me put you on the spot a little bit. What was your favorite piece in musical theater?
Oh, there are many. I would probably say Sweeney Todd.
And why would you pick Sweeney Todd?
Because when I saw that musical on Broadway, it was just prior to the Tony Awards, so it was still somewhat fresh. I was so drawn into it because it has a feeling of musical theater and opera in it. It's mostly sung, and I really enjoy. At the end of it, I remember sitting in the seat, and I couldn't move. I could not leave the seat for a moment because of the way that particular musical ends, where the chorus is looking, in fact, the entire ensemble is looking at the audience and saying, and singing, "Isn't that Sweeney there beside you?" Which I thought was such a powerful message that we don't know what someone else is going through every day, and that you don't know if the person who you've just been rude to is ready to snap or just needed someone to be nice to them. And so I think that's what the impact was, so real that it wasn't just an interesting musical. It had an impact on how I thought about people and life. And then I took that back into my classroom and taught my students that, especially my theater students, be kind to one another. You don't know what somebody else is going through right now.
Well, it's a it, it might be a ways from Sweeney Todd to Beach Reads. How did you get from theater to Beach Reads?
Well, I had been doing the writing in grade school and in high school, and then in college it was killed in me because I became an English major, and therefore I had to read as opposed to wanting to read and wanting to write. And after that's why I say 25% of my life. My life is broken into four things, it seems like. You know, the childhood, then the college and teaching, and then it was the theater, and now it's back to the writing again. So it really was that I enjoy doing theater, but the need to be a writer has been in me since I can remember. My parents say that the first thing they did when I could sit up in bed by myself, in a crib even, they put golden books in my hands, because they wanted me to be a reader. So I was meant to be a writer, too.
Are you doing any theater today in addition to your writing?
No, I'm requested sometimes to come back to Baltimore, where there is a very active, really active, wonderful community theater there besides the summer theater programs. But I'm just tired. You reach a point as a director in particular, but also as an actor in musical theater because of dancing and singing, you do reach a point in your arts life where you say, I'm too tired now. I could pass this information on to someone younger and let them take it. But for me, the writing is actually more freeing to me right now because I have the time to do it and I've found my niche.
Well, Nancy Sakadusky, you're the master of Beach Reads, and Nancy Sherman as well. I'd like to ask both of you, what in the world is a Beach Read? And how do I recognize a Beach Read when I see one, other than it might be set on the Jersey Shore or in Rehoboth or Dewey Beach. So we start with you, with this Nancy.
I do think people's definitions vary. I had a friend who took Anna Karenina to the beach, so I think some people's definition of Beach
Read.
Not
reads, a Beach Read from what I know of it now.
But I think my definition would be a Beach Read should be something that when you go to the beach, you want to sort of be taken away from your daily life. It doesn't mean you want only frivolous things. It doesn't mean it has to be funny or romantic or any special thing. It just has to be diverting. And ideally, it's also well written. I think, unfortunately, some of the quote unquote beach reads tend to be just sort of slapped together and so light that they really have no substance at all. I like to think the beach reads we produce, and Nancy Sherman is certainly a prime example, have substance, but they're also very diverting. And I think stories that take place at the beach make particularly good beach reads because you're in the moment and you have a sense of being at the beach, you're reading about the beach, it enhances your experience.
Well, you're certainly a promoter of Rehoboth, mm-hmm. Of Rehoboth Beach with your work. But go back to the contest for just a moment, if you would. And when is your next submission period going to open? And how are the pieces chosen?
The contest runs from March 1st to July 1st each year, and the winners, in the sense of both the cash winners, there's cash prizes donated by Browse About Books, which is the contest sponsor. There are cash prizes for the top three stories, but about 20 to 25 stories are chosen to be in the book each year. The judging is done by a panel of six judges. They change somewhat each year. I keep some that have been there and have some experience, but I also mix it up with some new judges, and I try to get people from different geographic locations, although still nearby, people with different backgrounds, people with different tastes, so that I'm giving everybody a fair shot. The judging is completely blind. They get no information at all on the author. They don't know their age, their background. They don't know anything about them. I even removed the file information from the Word document when I send it, so they can't even look and try to find information on who the writer is. And so they go through several readings to narrow the field down from the submissions and to get it down to the finalists. And then I go from the top to the bottom and fit as many stories as I can into the book. I aim for a certain size book. And so when I get to the book being full, that's the last story that's chosen for that year.
Well, if I were to think about submitting a short story to Beach Reads, to the new, first of all, I've got to know what the theme is.
Right.
So I've got to write to that theme. Second of all, I understand that it has to have something to do with Rehoboth. That name has got to appear somehow. In addition to that, what are you going to be looking for from me? What do I need to give you in order to get in that next edition of Beach Reads?
From what I've seen of the stories that the judges select and from what they've told me, they look for a story that fulfills all the guidelines, and the guidelines are on the website. It's very, very clear specifications in terms of how long the story is, the connection to Rehoboth, fitting the theme, and so forth. But they look for a story that fits all those specifications, but the author has done something creative. It's not a literal interpretation of the theme necessarily. They've twisted it in some way. They've tweaked it. They've come up with a different way of approaching it. And for whatever reason, that's made that story stand out. They certainly look for their judging criteria includes quality of writing as an example. So they're looking for the quality of the writing, but creativity is also one of the criteria. So they're looking for someone who has written within the theme, but has stretched it a little bit.
And length?
We're the length is specified.
We're on the beach now,
and
the kids are
the
kicking sand,
specified.
The radio is going on the next. How am I going to focus on this?
You know, when you
thing?
Say what's a beach read, I think short stories do make ideal beach reads for that very reason. So the story lengths for our books are 500 to 3,500 words, and it can't go a single word over.
Is there a rule that you have in terms of the length you just said?
Yes. It gets disqualified if it's over that or under that, 500 to 3,500 words.
Well, you'd say, and let me turn to you, Nancy. Nancy Sherman? Now, what is a beach read for you?
Well, I agree with what Nancy said, because when I first started out to do short stories, it was because I came to Rehoboth and I wanted to read something on the beach. I thought, well, I'll get a collection of short stories because magazines, all I do is look at the photographs. It's nothing good there. And books, I didn't want to commit to a book because I love the water. I love being by the water. I don't want to spend the whole day reading. I want to spend the time also with the water. And I went into one of the local bookstores, and the only short story collections were classical short stories, which I certainly didn't want as entertainment, so it didn't exist. So I was, at that point, I was competing and getting published occasionally by Delaware Beach Life magazine. So when Beach House was announced by this person named Nancy Sakadusky, who I'd never met, I was really excited. I thought, that's what I wanted to do, except that now, instead of having to do this somehow on my own, I can see whether or not she'd be interested in my whole collection, because I'd been writing them for quite a while, and I hadn't just been doing Rehoboth. I'd been doing other beach towns, too. And so we were at a Rehoboth Beach Guild gathering, and another friend said, oh, that woman over there, that's Nancy Sakadusky. She's the one at Cat and Mouse Press. And I went, okay. And I went over and pitched my book. And Nancy said, well, let's get together. Send me some more of your stories.
This was Sandy Shorts.
That was the first one, the Sandy Shorts. So what I think of as beach reads is what Nancy said. It's something that you can read a story, then go in the water for a while. You can read another story, then go get pizza, you know. And you don't have to make this huge commitment that a novel has. And also, if you get distracted by the kids, it's not like you have to start over on page one when you're on page 300. You can start on page one because you were on page five, but you can start over again. And it just makes it a nice escape without closing in the amount of time you get to actually look at the water or be in the water and be with family.
Well, let me press this just a little bit, Nancy Sakadusky. You, on your website, says that you publish playful books, and you mentioned that as well. You've given us a definition of beach reads. How does playful fit into that definition of beach reads that you gave us?
I like to think we don't take ourselves too seriously. We're looking for quality writing, but we're willing ourselves to extend the guidelines a little and look at things that are a little out of the ordinary. A perfect example is one of our latest books, Beach Pulp, where we took the old pulp magazine sort of style of the screaming headlines and the giant creatures and the aliens from other planets. And we said, hey, what if that happened at the beach towns near us? And so we announced we were going to do a pulp fiction sort of collection, but the stories had to take place in our beach towns. And it was a fun project. It was different for us. It was genres we don't normally see much of: science fiction, fantasy, horror, noir. But it was a fun project because, again, it brought in different writers, different styles, and the book's been very popular. We got an artist named Joe Palumbo who really captured the spirit of the old pulp magazines for the cover. It's got a giant crab and a woman, you know, running away in terror, just like they did on the old magazines. So that was a type of book that I would say is playful.
We're going to read something from one of the pulp. Beach pulp stories later, a little bit later in the broadcast. I wanted to ask both of you, as I read your stories, Nancy, I'm not a student of romance fiction, quite frankly, so
it's a surprise.
I'll own up to a little lack of knowledge in the romance fiction era. But as I read your stories, I thought that they sounded and seemed a little romantic to me. And I'd like to talk for a moment about romance fiction and how it fits your short stories. So what for you is romance fiction, and how does it fit into your short story writing?
Well, I know my audience, and my audience to whom I was gearing my stories were women between the age of 18 and 120. You know, that's what they're meant for. And romance, at least a little romance in something, or definitely relationships between people, whether it's romantic relationship or just a friendship, those things are something that are universal and that we like to read about them. You know, sometimes we want to escape and say, oh, wouldn't it be great if this knight in shining armor swept you off your feet and took you away to the castle and you became the queen. I mean, that's extreme. But the idea that I think that we like the fantasy life, it doesn't mean that we don't have our own romance in our lives, you know, our own husbands or boyfriends or, in cases, girlfriends and wives and all. It's not that we don't have that, but it is sometimes fun to escape into a fantasy world where you watch someone else and feel someone else going through one of those situations. So I try to put that particular type of story into my collections, but then some of them are not romantic romance stories, though they may have an aspect of romance in them, and they definitely usually have an aspect of love in them. But that's the balance I try to keep. I know who my audience is, and because I know what I want to read on the beach also. So that's what I would say.
Yeah, in terms of the romance, are there particular elements of a romance fiction? I keep wanting to say romance novel, but we're not talking about novels here.
Right,
we're talking
right.
about short stories, romance fiction. Are there elements that need to go into a romance fiction piece, even if it is designed around Rehoboth Beach, and so it's going to be a beach read.
Well,
and let me ask you, Nancy, to Sakadusky, to join in on this discussion as well.
Right. Romance is a really large genre right now with subgenres in it. And we were discussing this on the way over in the car, actually. And the type of romance, I can't believe I'm stuttering, the place of romance that I try to work toward is what they're now calling clean fiction or clean romance, meaning that there is a love involved. There's always, anytime you have literature, there's some sort of a conflict going on, whether it's between the two characters or from an outside force. But there's love involved. There is the kiss, the hug, all those things. But it's not erotica. It's nowhere near it.
There are no ripped bodices here. There may be a few unbuttoned bodices.
But no ripped bodices. And so, consequently, someone who is into that part of romance would probably find this more innocent, but they doesn't mean they can't understand the story and enjoy the story, because the relationships are real, the feelings are real, and there are always the conflicts like there would in the other one. Just isn't. I'm going to turn this over to Nancy because I know she's waiting to say something.
I think it gets back to what is classified as a beach read. And I think when somebody is relaxing on the beach, they don't necessarily want to come across graphic sex and graphic violence. And I think that's what Nancy means by clean fiction. It's not that we censor anything. It's that you want to provide the reader with what they're expecting. And when they're reading what they think is a collection of light beach reads, you want to make sure that that's what they're going to get.
Is there, I'm thinking in terms of what the elements of romance fiction might be, and even to some degree romance as it applies to beach reads. Is there always, and I'm relating back to some of your stories, Nancy, is there always a Prince Charming? And I use that
as
kind of a general. Is there always the guy with his dark complexion and blue eyes and black hair and so forth? So is there always a prince charming in these stories, or almost always?
And at some point we start to see them as the Prince Charming, but quite often there's the beginning struggle of, I don't like you, which is very much a part of romance too. There's a conflict that goes on between them. But
that sets the dynamic.
It's a nice escapism when you can picture these gorgeous men who are interested in the young woman who may or may not be interested in being involved with that particular guy. So I would say, from a woman's point of view, I'm probably going to get really yelled at for that by somebody, but just from my understanding, is that we do enjoy the happily ever after, and we do enjoy the time of the romance. And the conflict is what makes it all the more interesting, because you have to overcome something in order to end up being together. So the idea of having this person be this like knight in shining armor with the big muscles and the great tan and all that, that's not necessary, actually. But sometimes I think stories lend themselves to, at least that's the perspective of the female character. The guy might not look gorgeous to someone else, but to this female character, he really is a nice-looking guy, but it's more important that he's a nice guy in the stories.
And in terms of our books in general, getting away from Nancy's in particular, as is true in real life, not all our romances that are in these books are a man and a woman.
Right.
We're set in Rehoboth, which is the fourth largest gay community in the country. Mm-hmm. So indeed, in some of our books, it's a gay or a lesbian romance.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me go back for just a moment and ask a cultural question. Mm-hmm. There's that seems to me, and both of you can respond to this, it seems to me in our, where we are in our culture now, there is a thin line in literature, romance literature perhaps, between the woman finding her prince charming, and for some reason the prince charming adds fullness to her life. And I guess what I'm trying to come at is is in these books, are we promoting the idea that a woman needs a man in order to fulfill her femininity and fulfill her life? Because that was so much our culture for so long, and we moved beyond that to a great extent now. So ask perhaps both of you to respond to that in terms of your writing.
Well, in terms of my writing, I will say that I am the most independent, liberal woman around, and I didn't get married till I was in my late 50s. So I don't, I write stories for my audience, and I enjoy writing those stories, and I enjoy the fantasies of the stories, but I don't think I write weak women.
I would agree with that.
Strong, independent women who happen to, you know, end up being with someone who they really thought was great.
And although this is what we're talking about, certainly romances are not the only thing Nancy writes. Many
That's
of her
true.
Stories have no romance at all. They have nothing to do with romance.
Yeah.
Well, I having read a number of your stories, Nancy, I will agree with you that the women you present are generally very strong and very accomplished. Women. But I keep running into that man who is dark complected with the blue eyes and the black hair, who maybe lives in the garage next door, for instance. And so anyway, I had to ask the question. You're going to read for us. Nancy, what are you going to read for us?
I'm going to read the story, The Healing Power of Feeding Sea Girls. And it takes place in Bethany Beach. Kara woke to a growling stomach. She wished she'd done some grocery shopping before coming to this beach condo, but she'd been exhausted after the long drive yesterday from Baltimore, Maryland to Bethany Beach, Delaware. She hadn't even unpacked yet. Instead, she'd fallen asleep across the bed and into a deep sleep. Barb, a dear friend, who was also the principal at the school where Kara was a teacher, had sent her here. Bethany Beach will be a healing retreat, she said to her. I doubt it, Kara thought. She questioned whether time at a beach could repair the gaping hole she felt inside, nor would it stop the events of last week from springing to life again. When her doorbell had rung early in the morning and she'd opened the door, the sight of two uniformed members of the armed services, both with their hats held to their chests, had brought her life to a screeching halt. She couldn't talk. She couldn't even cry. She could only feel her heart break. She nodded and indicated they could come into the house. She led them to the living room, where she slowly lowered herself onto her husband Mark's favorite chair. Probably the worst choice she could have made. As she sank into the soft brown corduroy, she sobbed uncontrollably and unabashedly to the point of hyperventilation. One of the soldiers brought her a glass of water while the other, an army chaplain, knelt beside her and handed her his handkerchief. The next morning, after the news channels released the names of the four soldiers who had died, her phone rang and rang and rang until she finally shut it off. Not able to reach her, Barb drove to Kara's house and assured her that her class would be covered for the remaining 2 weeks of school. That's when she offered Kara the condo in Bethany Beach. It's just a tiny efficiency on the second floor of an old beach house, but it's only two blocks from the boardwalk and the beach. Kara saw a half-drunk bottle of ginger ale she'd left out on the counter last night. It should have been put into the refrigerator, but at room temperature, it tasted okay and would hopefully settle her stomach enough to get her to a cafe where she could order breakfast. She sipped the flat soda as she sat by the window that overlooked the yard of the house that backed up to the property. On the porch of that house, an elderly woman in a summer house dress sat at a wicker table across from a small red-haired child wearing a blue denim romper. Between them, a silver tray held a floral china tea set. The woman's tea ritual mesmerized Kara. The delicate tongs that lifted cubed sugar to the teacup, the tilt of the cream pitcher, the swirl of the spoon. She envied the child for having this time with a grandparent. Kara wished her Grams were alive. Grams could heal her with the strength of a kiss on top of a Band-Aid. The memory was too much for Kara. She slipped into her sandals and set out in search of food and a freshly brewed cup of coffee. At the corner of Pennsylvania Avenue and Garfield Parkway, she found Beach Break Bakery and Cafe. With a large coffee in one hand and a sticky bun in the other, she wandered down the main street toward the boardwalk and beach, glancing at the shop windows on her way. She stopped at the four-window corner of Bethany Beach Books and looked inside at the book displays. She scanned the groupings of books and wondered what she'd want to read. At any other time in her life, she'd have chosen a romance, but not today. Maybe a book of comic essays, something to make her laugh and escape this summer of sadness. With her right hand messy from the sticky bun, she couldn't go inside. Maybe later, after she washed her hands. After cleaning up in the public restrooms on the boardwalk at the end of Garfield, she found an empty bench and sat facing the ocean with her feet propped up against the wooden railing that separated the boardwalk from the sand dune engineered to keep the ocean from flooding the stores during Nor'easters. A seagull positioned itself at her feet. "Dumb bird," she almost said aloud. "I don't have anything to eat. You're wasting your time." "Shoo!" She hated seagulls. When she was 12, a seagull had deposited a messy dropping on her favorite beach towel. She never used that towel again, even though her mom insisted that the washing machine had made it all new again. Oh, for a washing machine that can make me new again. The white-blue sky was almost cloudless, and the sun was already warming the sand. She watched a young family with two boys head toward the steps that led down to the beach. One was pulling at his mom's arm, straining to get to the beach sooner, while the other was riding piggyback on his dad, who had his arms filled with beach chairs and an umbrella. It made Kara think of Mark's arms, how he worked out, how he could bench press her, how safe she used to feel in his embrace, how he would have been a great daddy for their kids if only they hadn't waited to get pregnant. Her eyes burned, not from the sun, but because she refused to cry again. To give in to grief would be to accept that Mark was gone. She wasn't ready to concede that unavoidable truth. A high-pitched voice called out, "Granny, here, here!" The child plopped on the bench beside her. Kara recognized the denim romper and bright hair, now neatly braided. This was the little girl she'd seen from the window of the condo. The grandmother approached the bench and said to the little girl, "Elise, did you ask the nice lady if she would mind sharing the bench?" Elise looked into Kara's face, then back to her grandmother. "Why?" The woman leaned over and in a soft voice explained, "Because it's the polite thing to do." "Oh," then she said, "Miss, can me and Granny sit here?" Kara wanted to be alone, but she knew that someone would eventually sit on the empty half of the beach. These two were as good a choice as any. Besides, the woman reminded her of a happy time in her life, a time spent with her Grams. "Of course you can sit here." She almost said, "can sit here with me," but that would invite conversation, something that she didn't intend to suggest. The woman opened a bag of breadcrumbs, and the purpose of their visit became clear. They were there to feed the seagulls, an idea that made Kara regret her consent. At the first toss of food over the railing, gulls gathered on top of the dune as though they were extras in a remake of Hitchcock's The Birds. She weighed how soon she could leave the bench without appearing rude. "They're always happy to see us," the elderly woman said. Elise offered Kara a handful of crumbs. "Would you like to feed the seagulls too?" Seagirls. It was cute, just like Elise. Kara had always imagined that she and Mark would have boys, but the bright green eyes of this little girl presented a new image, her husband lifting Elise on his shoulders so she could toss the bread higher into the air, Daddy's little girl. She shouldn't have let her mind go there. She stared out at the ocean, refusing to let her eyelids move. She didn't need to look down to know that the little girl had moved closer. "This is for you," Elise said. Kara could see the little hand reaching up and holding out a piece of bread. The first tears escaped, and once released, the rest poured in a torrent. She could no longer contain her emotions. "I'm sorry," she managed to say, aware that the little girl was staring at her. "Why is she crying?" the child asked. The grandmother handed the bag of breadcrumbs to her. "Elise, go down on the beach and spread these a little farther so more of your sea girls can eat." Elise obeyed and skipped down the walkway and the stairs to the open sand. Then the woman turned to Kara. "Is there anything I can do for you?" She wasn't Graham's, but that didn't matter. The words rushed out about Mark, about he and the three other soldiers who died in the airplane crash, not shot down over a battlefield, but crashed over a military airfield as a result of mechanical failure. Not that the reason mattered. He was gone. When Kara had exhausted the details of last week, she spoke about her marriage to the most wonderful man in the world. She opened her cell phone and located a photograph of Lieutenant Colonel Mark Anderson. He was smart and brave and funny and kind. She smiled, but for only a moment. "And now I'm all alone." She looked up at the sky and asked, "What do I do now?" She took a deep breath, then exhaled slowly, ending in a small burst of, "Ah." The woman, who had listened in silence until Kara's words stumbled into that sigh, answered, "You know in your heart what needs to be done. Surely, as your husband was a smart, brave, funny, and kind man, he wouldn't want you to live in the land of regrets. I know it's easy for me to say this, but you must be brave, too. You must go forward." Kara wiped her eyes with her T-shirt sleeves. "But how?" The woman gazed at the beach where her grandchild was dancing in the sand under a shower of breadcrumbs. "So many people hate the seagulls. My husband Henry insisted we feed them. He reminded me and anyone else who would listen that the gulls are God's creatures too. When my Henry died, I stopped saving bread for the gulls. I avoided the beach and stayed home with my grief. Then one morning when I walked to the mailbox, I saw a sparrow tugging at a worm to feed its young. That's when I finally cried, and my tears brought a clarity I'd been missing for months. I realized how, in trying to bury my pain, I'd buried everything that had ever made me happy. I'd buried everything that was good about my Henry. So I feed the gulls again, and I teach Elise what Henry taught me." Kara appreciated the story shared by the stranger, this substitute for her own wise grandmother. It reminded her of the importance of family, including extended family like her friend Barb. "Is your granddaughter visiting for the summer?" The woman shook her head. "No, Elise lives here year-round. Her parents are gone. She was a baby, too young to remember them or the accident. Miraculously, she was unharmed when the drunk driver hit their car head-on. I do my best to protect her innocent joy. I hope I'm blessed with enough years to see her off to college. In the meantime, I live in the present, trying to make each day special." Elise rushed up to her grandmother. "All done." "All done," her grandmother repeated. Then to Kara, "It's never easy, but after the tears and acceptance of the truth, the hill isn't so hard to climb anymore." The woman stood, brushed a few stray crumbs from her skirt, and took her grandchild's hand. Kara watched the elderly lady as she ambled down the boardwalk with the little girl. She imagined a Henry walking next to them and almost believed she saw the outline of just such a man in the air beside the old woman. A daydream, of course, but it was comforting. She felt a flutter near her feet. A sparrow landed and grabbed one of the crumbs that had fallen on the boardwalk. It looked up at her before it flew away, tilting its head from side to side as though trying to figure her out. "Are you Henry Sparrow?" she asked the bird. Kara felt a warm breeze flow over her body from head to toe, though there was very little movement in the seagrass that separated the boardwalk from the beach. For a second, she wondered how that was possible, feeling what didn't exist. But something from deep inside implored her to just gratefully accept any gentle reminder of the love she'd shared with Mark.
Not a frivolous story.
No.
at all. And I wonder how it fits the description of Beach Reads here, because it's quite a serious piece of work. You're going to read another piece for us. And then explain the difference to us, if you would. This will be a fairly short selection from this story.
This is the first three pages of a story called Works Hard for Her Money, which takes place on the Cape May Lewis Ferry. "Don't touch that, Cody!" Grace grabbed the 8-year-old's hand before he could pull the bar of the emergency alarm on the parking level wall of the Cape May Lewis Ferry. "I'm not Cody," the boy insisted. "I'm Jody." Grace took note of the stripes on the boy's shirt and those on the shirt of his identical twin. Switching identities was their favorite trick, but as their nanny, she had long ago figured out the key. Cody's clothing was usually his favorite color, blue, and Jody's was usually green. "No, you're Cody, Mr. Blue Stripes." The boy's face puckered with displeasure at being outsmarted. Though Grace now had Cody restrained, the challenge was not over. Another small hand reached for the lever. "Stop it, Jody." She pulled the other boy's hand away from the alarm. Then, with the twin boys in tow, she led the way to the main passenger area of the second floor of the ferry and seated them in a booth by the windows. "Only 85 minutes until freedom," she chanted silently in her mind. In little over an hour, she would turn over her two charges to their grandparents, who would spoil them for 2 weeks at their Cape May home before delivering the little brats to Goose Rocks Academy for Boys in Kennebunkport, Maine, where the twins would experience their first year of boarding school. Grace wondered if the headmaster and teachers were prepared for these unruly identicals. "I'm thirsty." "Me too." Grace expected difficulties throughout the trip from Lewis, Delaware to Cape May, New Jersey, but she was counting on this table with a view of the bay to keep the boys distracted from their usual mischiefs. "Stay here. I'm giving you both a great responsibility. Your jobs are to guard this booth so no one else takes it while I get you drinks from the food court." She pointed to where she'd be going. "That's the food court. I'll be keeping an eye on you. Don't leave the booth for any reason." "But what if the ferry starts to sink?" Cody asked. "I guess you'll have to go down with the ship, just like a ship's captain is expected to do." Grace walked sideways, knowing she probably looked foolish, but also knowing that she'd better keep her eyes on the Dowell twins. Inside the food court, she bypassed the soda fountain, and with her eyes still focused on the twins, she grabbed two juice boxes. But then she made a major mistake. She decided to pour a small black coffee for herself. When she looked back at the booth, only Jody was still seated there. She stood tall to see if Cody was hiding down the seat. No luck. She rushed toward the cashier, handed her a $10 bill. "Keep the change." "You forgot to get this." Cody stood behind her, holding up an extra large cup of soda. Grace took the cup from Cody's hand and gave it to the cashier. "I assume that the 10 will cover this too. If you like cola, it's all yours." With the juice boxes safe in the side pocket of her purse and her coffee firm in one hand, she grabbed Cody's hand with her other. "I hate you," he said. She looked down at him with a tight smile. "No problem. I'm just a little bit more time with you, and then you won't have to listen to me anymore." When she looked up, Jody was no longer guarding the booth. She tossed her full coffee cup into a trash can and dragged Cody down the aisle. "What's the plan, Cody? Where did Jody go?" Cody glared at her. "How should I know?" "This is serious, Cody. Someone could kidnap your brother." "That's okay with me. I don't want a twin anyway," she said, the first thing that popped into her mind. "You shouldn't say that. Someday you might need one of his kidneys." And actually, this story does go into a romance.
Yes, I read the story and I know the ending, and it does go into a romance. So Prince Charming shows up on the deck.
Those two readings show the breadth of Nancy's writing, and that is the characteristic that people love about her work is they know that they're going to get a book that's going to take them on a roller coaster of light and fun and silly stories and on very deep stories like the one she read previously. That was a story that I would argue is a beach read. It's something with some meat in it, but I think there are a lot of people who like that, and it's a very satisfying story, and that's why she has a lot of fans, as they like to see that in her books.
Well, we have a few minutes left, so let's turn to beach pulp and the kind of noir. And because our time is a little short, why don't you go ahead and start, Nancy,
all right,
and then we'll talk about beach pulp a little bit. Is the story?
So this is a story by Linda Chambers. It takes place at Funland in Rehoboth Beach in the 1970s. A young girl has gotten a scare at the Haunted Mansion ride, and the teenage employee, who's the narrator, has promised to show her that there's nothing to be afraid of. Her dad is bringing her back after closing, and her this narrator's work partner's name is Sam. He helps her run the ride. Dad and daughter appeared as we were shutting down for the night. I could see her more clearly now, red hair and freckles and bright blue eyes. She was wearing one of those matching short and shirt ensembles, very popular at that time. Blue top and red shorts, both splattered with tiny white stars and fishes. Dad had a medium-sized teddy bear tucked under one arm. "I thought she'd forget," he said wearily. "Not Nancy." "Go ahead, honey," he said to her. "You said you wanted to." "Can we go in now?" Nancy said to me, eyes shining with excitement. "Sure," I said. I turned to Sam. "I'll finish inside. You close out." "My wife is going to kill me," the little girl's dad muttered, lighting a cigarette. The generator lights were on in the tunnel. I held out my hand. Nancy looked at it disdainfully. "Oh, yes, you are," I told her, and she sighed and took it reluctantly. We trudged through the tunnel until Nancy stopped. "Here," she said. "It was here." "Okay," I replied. I handed her the flashlight. "Hold this and stand back." She obeyed. There was a trigger on the track that engaged the ghost dummy. I stamped my foot down on it with enough force to part the folds in the black curtain and propel the dummy forward. I flung my arms around it and pulled it into the light so she could see its white-painted face, black holes for eyes, and plastic skeleton hands. As I dragged it forward, dust billowed up my nose and I sneezed. One of its fingers brushed painfully across my cheek. "Here you go," I huffed. The thing was heavier than I expected it to be. "See? Nothing to be afraid of." The beam of flashlight wasn't on the dummy. It was bouncing off the curtains. It landed on the opening and back behind them. There were numerous openings throughout the ride. They led to a narrow walkway so workers could access the mechanisms that operated the displays. "Nancy?" "It wasn't that one," she said. She was peering beyond me, aiming the beam at the opening. She stepped forward. "Whoa, hang on there," I said. She halted. I eased the dummy back against the wall and turned to her. "This is the only one, honey," I said. "This is what you saw." She shook her head, still staring at the opening. "No, it wasn't." "I swear this is the only one." "No, it had a face. There is nothing else back there." "Nancy," her father bellowed from outside. "Let's go." "On our way," I shouted back. "Let's go," I repeated. She shifted her gaze from the opening to me. In the generator's half light, her eyes were luminous. She tilted her head to one side and studied me briefly before slowly nodding her head. She was giving in, as children usually do, because they have to. She was bowing to the stronger of us, to me, the grown-up, and to her father's command from outside. Yet it was absolutely clear to me that I was the one who was wrong, and she'd made the adult decision to simply let it go. She knew the truth, not me. It was as though she'd made the whole argument in her head, and, knowing she would never be able to convince me of it, she simply gave up trying. "Okay," she said, holding the flashlight out to me. As I took it, she said, "Your cheek's bleeding." She turned and trotted toward the entrance. I turned, too, and looked back at the curtain. Most of it had fallen over the opening in the wall. I lifted my arm and stretched out my hand to pull it aside. The hand flashed out from the darkness, its pale skin white against my deep summer tan. The fingers that curled around my wrist were slender and beautifully shaped, but strong, so strong. I gasped. I heard Sam as though from a great distance. You good in there? I felt my heart pound. It was in my chest and in my ears. Sam, I whispered. The hand that encircled my wrist drew me through the curtain. He was taller than me. I had to look up. Now I understood what Nancy had seen, what had beckoned her forward. His eyes were gray. Those eyes locked me to him. I couldn't look away. He took hold of my chin and tilted my head to one side. He leaned forward and pressed his lips against my cheek, kissing it languidly, leisurely. His mouth drifted down my cheek to my throat. Something cold and sharp brushed my flesh. Your cheek's bleeding. I heard Sam again, but he was miles away. The few yards that separated the outside of the ride from its dark center stretched all the way to the ocean. And what must have been an impatient shout was barely a whisper. Something like, "You good?" He lifted his head. His eyes were as luminous as Nancy's. I thought of my life. I thought of home. I thought of school and the plans I'd made. I couldn't remember exactly what they were. Yes, I said. Then realizing Sam couldn't hear me, raised my voice. I'm good. Okay, see you tomorrow. Don't forget the lights. Silence. We were still staring at each other. I thought I saw a question. Maybe I did. Maybe I didn't. In any case, I answered it. I want the dark ride, I whispered, and arched my neck. He obliged.
A wonderful story.
That was called The Dark Ride by Linda Chambers.
Yeah, again, I read that whole story, mm-hmm. and I really encourage our listeners to read it mm-hmm. and come to the end, because there is a twist mm-hmm. At the end that reveals all. It's really quite good.
I'd like to mention that Patrick Conlon was the associate editor on that book, and he helped me select the stories. He did a great job, because we do have some great stories in that book.
Nancy, run down the list of the books again for our listening audience. Well, I've got them right here in front of me. Right. Sandy Shorts.
Okay.
And from someone who grew up next to the ocean and the beach. I know what Sandy Shorts are. And then Nancy Sherman, in addition, more Sandy Shorts we've talked about today. And then
Beach Pulp was a collection with multiple authors. It was an anthology that Patrick Conlon helped me collect. It was it's a curated collection.
Well, Nancy Sakadusky and Nancy Sherman, I want to thank both of you very much for sharing your thoughts and your readings with us today. Writing is definitely very much alive mm-hmm. on the eastern shore of Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. And thank you, Nancy Sakadusky, and your publishing, Cat and Mouse Press.
My pleasure.
For promoting mm-hmm. and supporting the writers in the region. Thank you both for being here. And thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.